Hello and welcome to Beyond the Back Page on Near FM with myself, Patrick Donoghue. My guest on the show today is Robert O'Connor. Robert is the author of a fascinating book entitled Blood and Circuses, A Football Journey Through Europe's Rebel Republics. The book takes a look at the role of football in some of the disputed regions of the former USSR and Yugoslavia. And I'm delighted to say that Robert is joining me on the line. Robert, thanks so much for joining me today. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm good, Patrick. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
No problem. So, Robert, I might start. As I said, the book is really, really fascinating. It gives a glimpse into regions that I, reading, would not have been aware of. Could I just start by asking you, what inspired you to write the book?
Well, I was always interested in Eastern Europe, I think, going back to, you know, when I was a teenager. You know, that's probably not the classic kind of thing for 18-year-olds in the UK to be hoovering up. My interest in it first came through the back door. I was, used to be really into the rock band System of a Down,
okay,
who are big kind of, they're of Armenian heritage, and they're very big on their kind of political activism, and they had this big campaign, which is still going on, for recognition of the Armenian genocide by the US government. And when I came to do my history A-level, as they are over here, we were kind of given free rein to go and just research a topic. You know, that could just be your topic. And so whilst all the rest of my classmates kind of listened to the guidance of the curriculum and the teachers and the, you know, things that we were already studying, I went and kind of camped out in Birmingham Central Library for a couple of weeks and put this project together on the Armenian genocide. And it kind of stuck from there, really. I think I was always interested in the way the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia disappeared so suddenly, and, you know, how there were suddenly all these new countries and new nations almost overnight in some cases. It seemed like such a bizarre way for a part of the world to work. We're so used in the UK and maybe less so in Ireland, but in Western Europe generally, we're used to this idea that borders are fixed and nations and countries are there, and that's how they've always been. And obviously, that's very different to how, you know, people in other parts of the world look at themselves. And it's just, it just came from there, really.
And you mentioned Armenia, and you, as part of the process of the book, you're in Armenia and Azerbaijan, and a conflict. There's a kind of an uneasy peace between Armenia and Azerbaijan there, and a conflict kicked off again in 2020. When you were over there chatting in both countries and in the disputed region there, did you pick up that there was some tension in the offering and that a war would not be far away? What was the sense when you were doing your when you were over in the two regions?
Yeah, I mean, well, tension is probably putting it too mildly.
Yeah.
Actually, I mean, it's not an exaggeration to say it forms part of their way of life. In both countries, they are brought up to hate one another. It's everywhere. It's in schools. It's in the media. It comes from the top down, from the government. It's written into their DNA. That the matter of Karabakh, this disputed land between them, is kind of sacred and is at the centre of their, in some cases, their national survival. And we mentioned there the Armenian genocide. The Armenian people see what's going on now, the war with the Azerbaijanis, or the Turks, as they pejoratively call them, and they see it as an extension of the Armenian genocide when the late Ottoman government wipes out about 1.5 million of them during the First World War. And so for both sides, it's seen as absolutely central to how they live their lives and how they define themselves as national groups. When I was there, it was in, I think it was, I was last there in early 2017. And, you know, by then there had been a 25-year ceasefire, maybe just less than 25 years. No, about 20 years. And there had been a bit of sporadic outbreaks of fighting in the years since. There had been a few dozen people killed the year before, but I don't think anyone was expecting this for it to blow up in the way that it did at the back end of last year, when it really went back, you know, into full scale hostilities, and it was an all out war. But you know, it was always just because they were in a ceasefire and a state of frozen conflict. This kind of hatred that they feel towards one another never ever went away.
Mm. And Armenia is an interesting country. They seem to be using football as a vehicle to kind of gain credibility. People might remember that they hosted the Europa League final a couple of years ago between Arsenal and Chelsea. Is that a common thing that you found, that football is used as a vehicle in some of these areas to kind of gain credibility and kind of court favour upon their political situation?
Yeah, I mean, Azerbaijan, actually, not Armenia.
Oh, sorry, apologies, yeah.
Yeah, and it was, Azerbaijan is the most prominent example of that, of using sport to kind of whitewash their reputation and, as you say, gain credibility internationally. I mean, they're the biggest, I don't want to say culprits, what's a kind of a less pejorative word for culprit. You know, they're the ones that are doing it more than anyone else because they can afford to, because they've got a lot of natural resources from the oil reserves in the Caspian Sea, which has financed this kind of ruthless, and it really is a ruthless crusade of kind of, you could call it urban regeneration around Baku, the capital. And sport has become a massive part of that, and particularly football. They had, as you said, they had the Europa League final. They're due to be hosting some matches at the European Championships in the summer, if that ever happens. And even if it does happen, it may not happen in Azerbaijan, because the last time when we were playing the European club fixtures before Christmas, when they played the internationals before Christmas, neither Azerbaijan nor Armenian clubs or the national teams were allowed to play at home by UEFA. Whether that will still be the case by the summer, it's tricky to say. You know, it's not just Azerbaijan. It's been done to a lesser extent all over these kind of disputed parts of Eastern Europe. Sometimes it's just a matter of kind of sanitising, you know, a company or a particular oligarch's reputation domestically. And when I was in Transnistria, which is the breakaway region of Moldova, which is backed by Russia, there's a club there that was built essentially as kind of the football arm of this corporation that runs the whole republic and runs it with a good degree of corruption. So it's not always just about the international reputation, although I suppose that's where we in Western Europe would look at it and be most alarmed by it. But, you know, it happens on a local level as well, because sport, well, I mean, everywhere, but particularly in Eastern Europe, is such a powerful tool for this kind of thing, for winning hearts and minds. It was such a, you know, it was taken very, very seriously by the one-party state in Yugoslavia and the USSR, and it still is.
Yeah, and is there some sadness in these regions for the decline? I'm thinking in the football sense, because you would have had late 80s, early 90s, you would have had Steaua Bucharest. So is there a feeling that football has been in decline, that I know communism would have been bad, an understatement again for civil liberties, but in a football sense, football would have been very, very strong in the communist era.
Yeah, I mean, there's two ways of looking at it. One, as you say, in the late 80s, when Steaua Bucharest won the European Cup, as was, and then Red Star Belgrade won it in 1991, there were some, and you know, there were other fabulously strong teams. Dynamo Kiev were a real kind of world power. The Moscow clubs were very strong. And of course, that's all gone now. And one of the, you ask if there's, you know, if people are hurt by that, people are disappointed and upset by that out there. Well, yeah, and they vote with their feet on that, and they simply, in a lot of cases, they just don't go to watch their local clubs anymore. I went to a game in the Armenian Premier League where I could count how many people were there. There was about 30, 35 people turned up to watch it for free. You know, they don't even charge an admission. And that's, you know, it used to be the case. Armenia produced Soviet champion at Yerevan in the 1970s. You get about 70,000-80,000 people would go and watch them. But now, you know, they don't want to go and watch kind of, and it really is third-rate football. I mean, I don't wish to be you know, Unkind is still kind of top flight football, and they're professionals and they're playing for places in the Champions League and the Europa League, and there's internationals in these teams. But the way football has just been left into neglect because there's no appetite for domestic local football in a lot of these countries. You know, that it's easier to just, and more appealing for young people to kind of sit at home and watch, you know, Bayern Munich or Manchester United on their laptop or their phone or the telly. But there's a reverse side to it as well. These clubs, obviously, they were some of the strongest clubs in Europe in the 70s and 80s, some of them. But there was a flip side to that, which there was a heck of a lot of cheating going on. It was your match fixing was a fact of life, certainly in the Soviet leagues. And it was, you know, dictated really that, you know, champions are only supposed to come from Kiev and Moscow. Mm. In fact, the Stalin's right-hand man, Lavrenty Beria, said as much to one of the top kind of Georgian stars of the day when he challenged him on, you know, why is it that Dynamo Tbilisi from Georgia can't win the title one of the years? And he said, champions come from Moscow and from Kiev. So there was a lot of cheating. I mean, players, you didn't have any say it kind of really over who you played for. If you're a talented player coming through, say, I don't know, Metalist Kharkiv in Ukraine, you're particularly good, you will be moved on to Dynamo Kiev. Mm. And then possibly eventually you'll be moved on to Spartak Moscow. You wouldn't really have any say in it. So, you know, it's wonderful to look back on and think of these fabulous rivalries that there were. Mm. And you know, that Dynamo Tbilisi team I mentioned won the Cup Winners' Cup in 1981. One of the following years, they beat Liverpool 3-0 when Liverpool were the champions. And it was what sent shockwaves around Europe in as much as football results ever did in those pre-digital days. But, you know, as I say, there was a clean side and a dirty side of the penny.
Mm. Yeah, and you mentioned Georgia there, and a lot of Irish people would be very familiar. Every time we are...
yeah, they seem to get them all the time.
We get them all the time, but yeah, but Georgia is a kind of, like, you make the point in the book, after independence, it was kind of like a failed state, and there's two disputed regions within Georgia. What extent is the Russians, what is the kind of, Putin seems to be destabilizing these regions. What is the role of the Russians, and what do you think their objective is within these disputed areas within Georgia?
Yeah. Well, I mean, their role is they finance them, is the first and foremost thing. And the two regions you're talking about are Abkhazia and South Ossetia.
Mm.
South Ossetia in particular, tens of thousands of people that live there. There's no real kind of natural resources to speak of. In other circumstances, it would be an insignificant, you know, aside for the people that live there. And Abkhazia is a slightly more strategic, significant case because it sits on the Black Sea coast. Previously was one of the outlets for Georgia and into the Black Sea. And it was the kind of the holiday hotspot for the Soviet nomenclatura because it's just such a gorgeous climate, subtropical climate. So, they couldn't survive independently without Russian backing. So Russia pays more than, I mean, at the time I was, you know, doing my work out there, it was more than half of the budget. And the rest, certainly in Abkhazia, comes from Russian tourism. What's the Russian objective there? And that's a little bit more difficult to pin down. I mean, Russia was always it's always felt a bit, since the USSR collapsed, Russia's felt very threatened by the fact that NATO has kind of continued to exist in the post-Cold War era. I think the feeling in Russia was, after NATO was founded, Moscow responded with the Warsaw Pact, which was the collective grouping of countries behind the Iron Curtain, which obviously dissolved after communism collapsed. But NATO kind of continues. And so Russia has always kind of felt, why does, you know, it's interpreted as a threat to their kind of national security. I mean, this is a country, remember, Russia, that was invaded a lot during the 20th century and suffered terrible. I mean, I know everybody the continent suffered terrible losses, material and human losses during both wars. But Russia and the Soviet lands suffered, you know, unimaginably. And so there has always been this defensive sense when it comes to Russian foreign policy that's survived until now. So when it comes to these otherwise insignificant seeming places like Zaporizhzhia and Abkhazia and Transnistria, and more recently you mentioned in the Donbass in Ukraine, it's about having a presence. You know, it's about having a military, economic, political presence in its what it still considers to be its own sphere. They call the former Soviet countries, they call it the near abroad in Russia. And Georgia is a particularly good example because Georgia really tries harder than any other post-Soviet state or post-USSR state, with the exception of the Baltics, to become part of the European, Western European, transatlantic family. You know, there was a lot of talk of them maybe joining NATO. Mm. They are part of a kind of a wider, kind of a loose strategic agreement with NATO. And so to Russia, that's a huge, but also a provocation. And so by keeping troops on the ground and having financial control over these places, it's them saying, well, no, this is our, you know, this is our sphere of influence. You say to Western Europe, okay, well, you're the EU swallowing up Poland and Hungary and, you know, Romania and Bulgaria and all these former Warsaw Pact states. And so it's Russia's way of saying, well, no, we'll defend, you know, our bit of Europe, our neighbourhood.
Mm. And before I let you go, Robert, is there any particular region down the line? I know we're all restricted travel-wise in your book. You take us through like areas, countries and regions people wouldn't think of going to. And really, really, it's a really, really fascinating read. Is there any particular countries that would you like to travel to and watch some football in the near future?
Oh, what you mean, going back to these places or
yeah, maybe future travel or other areas that are not explored. Yeah. Like, you know, is there any other countries that you'd like to explore?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't before, you know, everything that's happened, I had my eye on Central Asia and the former, because obviously the Soviet Union spilled quite a long way into Asia in what they call now kind of colloquially the Stan countries, so Kazakhstan.
Yeah.
Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Uzbekistan. Mm. I mean, there are fewer and fewer, you know, I mean, obviously not unexplored places, but, you know, the world, you know, obviously is opening up, and it's, you know, people, you know, the global neighbourhood is getting smaller. But Central Asia seems to be one of the few places, especially for somewhere of such size, that's still kind of shrouded in quite a lot of mystery and uncertainty, and part of that is to do with the regimes that are in charge there. Turkmenistan are probably kind of, you know, bettered on the kind of the oppressive state chart, and probably by North Korea. I mean, that's a real kind of Soviet throwback cult of the personality around the president. Really repressive press laws, restriction on movement, restriction on travel. And the same kind of hold to a lesser extent to some of those other countries around Central Asia. Mm. You know, that's kind of what I had in my eye. I kind of fancied the idea of maybe going out there and trying to do a similar kind of project as the last book, you know, looking at, you know, the football story. It's tricky because, I mean, Eastern Europe, Eastern Europe is kind of just familiar enough to us, I think, in the English-speaking world, for it to just about fall onto our radar and be interesting for something like football. But once you start to get into Central Asia, it's harder to sell it to people, I think. To be confirmed, I think.
Yeah, watch this space. Listen, Robert, thanks a million for joining us. Your book, Blood and Circuses, it's available now, I guess, Amazon or anywhere online. It probably is the best way for anyone that's interested. It's a really, really fascinating read. Thanks a million for joining us today.
Pleasure, Patrick. Thank you.
That was great. That was Robert O'Connor, author of Blood and Circuses, Football Journey Through Europe's Rebel Republics. Really, really fascinating read. Anyone interested, like myself, was speaking to Robert prior to coming online, it really ticks the boxes for me, a combination of football, politics and history. So anyone looking for a good, interesting, sort of a different lockdown read, I'd really, really recommend that for you.